legacy. As George mentioned, I'm a little bit sick, so if you can't hear me, say something. And during the course of the talk, I invite questions. Whatever you have, let's just speak up, and I'll get to you. But I might have a little trouble hearing, so just bear with me for a little bit. Okay, so this talk is about Jabber primarily. The Jabber JK is mostly just a starting title, because apparently that's a requirement. What we're going to cover is just a few basic points. First of all, it's an open protocol. I'm going to cover how it's put together by the various parties involved. Then we're going to do a little bit of its basic architecture. And in particular, we're going to highlight federation, how all the Jabber servers talk to each other, so that you could set up your own Jabber server and talk to any other Jabber server on the internet. And then we're going to do a few extensions that I happen to find useful. In fact, they're the extensions that we're using for a product we recently launched where I work. And then I'm going to show you a little demo of how all that stuff kind of comes together, assuming we have time. So Jabber is a protocol. I assume this matters to you guys. It's defined in two RFCs, 3920 and 3921. 3920 covers the core protocol, and it basically just covers how you set up a connection and the various semantics of the standards that go into it. 3921 expands on 3920 by showing how it's used for IM in particular. I will mention that I'm not going to talk about IM because I don't find it very exciting, but what I like about Jabber in particular is that it's very extensible and allows you to create real-time applications as opposed to simply focusing on IM. Jabber is maintained by the board of directors at the XMPP Software Foundation, who cover the business details of the Jabber organization, or XMPP organization, I should say. And it's really just business, like how they have to put documents together and so forth. They don't have much of it say day to day. And it's steered by the XMPP Council, which is voted on every year to try and get some new blood in there. And they're the people who upvote, downvote, extension protocols, and things like that, and try to direct the way Jabber should move from year to year. So, like I said, Jabber is defined primarily in 3920 and 3921. However, in order to facilitate extending it, they have a separate process outside the RFC system, which, as I'm sure most of you know, they have a number of criteria that can make it hard to try out new things. So they have what's known as ZEPs, XMPP extension protocols. And ZEPs are built on top of the core XMPP, built on top of the core XMPP protocol as defined in 3920. And they tend to be pretty small. They just cover individual aspects of like how you would extend it for things like publish, subscribe, ad hoc commands, voice over IP, and things like that. So they're very focused on specific details. As of now, there are 260, or there are a little over 260 ZEPs in various states. And the states range from final to experimental. And they have two types, informational and status track, which is the status track is stuff that you would implement. The informational steps are there to let you know how you should be thinking about the Jabber system. The XMPP architecture is focused on one thing primarily, and that's near real-time communication. What I mean by near real-time is that it's supposed to feel like real-time, but it doesn't have actual real-time constraints. The idea being that if you're sitting behind a computer and it's fast enough, then it's fast enough. You don't really need to worry about having it execute in a certain time slot. To enable that, everything in Jabber is asynchronous. Everything. If you had to have a request cycle, a request-response cycle in Jabber, then it would break down the real-time aspects of it. As it stands, since everything is asynchronous, you can make a request, and then at some point in the future, maybe, you'll get a response for it. As a result of that, it tends to be very scalable for certain kinds of applications. where your traditional methods of polling will just fall apart because you can't handle the number of connections coming in to continuously poll the system and try and prompt updates. So it's, again, geared towards a push type of system as opposed to your standard HTTP type system where you request data and you get a response. XMPP is built largely on how SMTP works, with a few modifications to facilitate real-time communication. So you have these things called JIT, the Jabber IDs, and they're global addresses, globally unique addresses. They look just like email addresses, except that they have that slash resource on the end, if you can see that. And that's necessary because you can have multiple clients connected to it, a specific Jabber server at a domain. So like, for instance, if you wanted to IM me, I'm BJC at KublaCon. But I can have, in fact, do have multiple connections to that from various devices. So if you wanted to talk to me at a specific device, then you would have to put the resource on there. So that's one of the changes that it's like a little different from SMTP, where SMTP, you know, you fire off a message and it just goes to one place. In Jabber, it can go to a number of places. JIDs are the way to address everything in Jabber. Everything that you can talk to has a JID, whether it be a server, whether it be a user, or like I said, a specific device. So I don't know if you can see the brackets up there, but the known app is optional, and so is the slash resource. If you omit the known app, then it will go to a server, typically. And if you put it there, it's going to go to an entity. And if you put the resource on there, it will go to a specific entity's device. Jabber is implemented as a XML stream, which is a little weird, I have to say. And it's not exactly XML. It's strict XML, I should say. It looks like it up until you try to close connections or restart them and things like that. So to open up a connection to a Jabber server, the first thing you do is you connect to the port, and then you send the stream command with various headers, and that starts the XML document, and from then on, you send stanzas to it. Stanzas are specific types of elements, and there's three of them, that have varying semantics, and they're the unit of communication. So everything that you're going to send to the Jabber server is going to be enclosed in one of these three types of stanzas, and it's going to include typically routing information as well. The XML streams, I should say, are also, they're based on endpoint-to-endpoint communication. So it's not like if I talk to Okan over there, I have an XML stream with him. I have an XML stream to my server. Okan has an XML stream to his server, and those servers have XML streams between each other. So they're really about device communication or server communication more than they are about person-to-person communication. Like I said, XML is a little weird. I mean, like when I first started investigating this stuff, we were looking for a real-time transport for our VoIP product, and I kind of poked some people that I knew, and XMPP came up, and one of the first things I got from somebody I respect a lot is, wow, XML help. And, you know, there's a certain amount of truth to that. You know, I'm not particularly fond of XML, but it does have a couple of big advantages. One is that XML is understood almost everywhere, at least these days. It's very easy in any number of languages to parse and use XML. And so that's nice. And on top of that, it's really trivially extensible by XML namespaces, which allows you, I mean, it's really the core of Jabber. The way all of these extensions work is by defining a new XML namespace with a given schema, and then shoving their data into those elements. So here are the three types of stanzas: presence, message, and IQ. And presence is a server broadcast stanza. In other words, when I send presence to my server, it then takes that and broadcasts it to everybody who is subscribed to my presence. Message is a one-way stanza. So I send a message to someone, And then that's it. I'm done with it. And I may or may not get a response to it, but it's literally just me to some person, and then I'm done. I never have to look at it again. IQ is your standard request response protocol. So when I send an IQ, I have to get a response back. So one of the attributes that you see on these standards, in addition to PROMIS 2, is ID, which uniquely identifies a given stanza within a stream. And the ID is just an opaque string. You know, if you can encode it in XML, then in an XML attribute, then it will work. So IQ requires IDs because, like I said before, it's all asynchronous. So if I sent a message out without an ID on it and I got a response back, I wouldn't have any way to associate it with the request that I sent. The generic protocol between endpoints is client to server, which is a device, a client device, talking to a specific Java server, which is typically a domain. Server to server, which is between domains. So if I'm at zizi.org and somebody else is at plu.org, then zizi and plu will communicate via S2S, and I will communicate with zizi via C2S. And components. Components are also streams. They're basically there to trivially extend servers so that you can implement custom behavior. And it's also logically, the protocol is logically peer-to-peer. So in other words, as I program it, I treat it as if I'm talking to the endpoint, not talking to any of the intermediate servers. And the servers handle the routing and all that other stuff. It is, in fact, like physically client to server to client in order to get things across. But like SMTP, I mean, it's like SMTP where you have to talk to your MX and then the MX delivers and then you pick it up. But it looks and you program it as if it's all, you know, client to client without thinking about the intermediate layers. So here's a little diagram. What we have here is a generic XMPP setup with federation. So we have Alice and Bob here at zizi.org. They communicate with zizi.org through C2S. And if they want to talk to Carol, who's at plu.org, then zizi.org has to create an S2S connection to plu.org. Then the message will get across to Carol. The S2S connections are multiplexed. In other words, if Alice and Bob are both talking to Carol, that there will only be one server-to-server connection created between Zizi and Plu. And likewise, if Carol is talking to both Alice and Bob, there will only be one SS connection between Zizi and Plu. We also have pubsub.zizi.org, which is living off of zizi.org as a component that's providing publish-subscribe functionality. So now I want to talk about the Zeps that I like, because we use them and they're very good. Service discovery is probably the most important core ZEP out there because it's what enables you to probe for features on a given server or a given client. What it does is you send it an IQ, which, like I said before, is a request response, and you ask it for its identity and for its items. Well, there's two discos, info and items. So, for instance, if I want to know whether or not it supports a given feature, I go and send an IQ to it, it responds with a list of features that it implements, and then I can decide how I want to deal with the server. So, every ZEP that you see out there pretty much builds off of that. So, if I have a PubSub component out there, I need to know if it's supported. I'll go and send an IQ to it, it'll return, Jabber or Sharp PubSub as a feature. And then I know those things work. And there are other things like multi-user chat, things like that, Jingle. Disco is broken down into two types of data, which are the info, which itself is broken down into two other types of data. It contains the identity of the features. So when I send a disco info request, it responds with identity of the server, which tells you what type of server it is, whether or not it's like a multi-user chat service, whether or not it it's a PubSub service and things like that, or a gateway. And it will also return the features that it supports. And it's worth noting that you can, that any given JIT can support many different identities. You can have a list of them in your XML, and in effect, you are all those types of services. And likewise with the features, if you support a number of features, it will just return them. Items is another, is the other half of Disco. It's how you probe for, like for instance, if I was trying to connect to a multi-user chat service and I wanted to know how many rooms there were on the Copper server, if I would execute a Disco items request, then it would return a list of chat services. If I do a Disco items on PubSub, it'll return a list of nodes that I can connect, that I can subscribe to, and so on. So while identities and features are all highly normalized and predictable, items change, like the nature of items changes depending on what kind of service you're looking at. There's also ad hoc commands, which Jabber ID, JID. It's the globally unique identifier for a given entity, any entity.
So you would send that request to the service to other clients?
You can send those requests to anything. If you ask, I mean, every client out there, every server out there today, if you send a Disco info request to them, they're going to respond to you. They're going to tell you what you can do. It's actually pretty useful. So, like, I use Adium primarily, and Adium supports off-the-record conversations. But you don't know that necessarily unless you request from my client whether or not it can do off-the-record conversations. So the way you do that is when I log in, it sends presence out there. And once I get responses from people, it'll go and query all the people in my roster and say, give me your features, give me your features, give me your features, give me your features. It gets them back, and now my client knows what kind of stuff it can support. This is used now, for instance, Jingle, which isn't very well supported. Jingle is the voiceover IP for Jabber. And it's not very well supported, so being able to probe for it is very useful, especially for things like UI. Like if I'm using Sai, for instance, which does support Jingle, and I want to create a voice call with you, that I need to know whether or not that's even possible. And I have to talk to your client to figure out whether that's possible. I can't talk to your server to figure that out. But you could also send this to servers to figure out what kind of capabilities they have there.
Disco is an extension, right?
What's that?
Disco is an extension?
Yes, it's an extension.
It's like a slash disco is the resource name?
No, I'm going a little fast here, sorry. When you send an IQ, all those standards that I talked about have XSDs, the W3C schema associated with them that are defined along with the rest of the protocol. And one of the requirements of IQ is that if it has any data at all, it's going to include one child element, which is a query, and it's going to have an XML and S of some namespace. And from that namespace, it can dispatch to figure out what you're trying to ask for.
So there is no central disco thing,
this
sort of thing, or there.
What do you mean central disco?
I mean, there's no service implementing disco on the. Like you talk to the Jabber server for a domain. There's no like one service supporting disco.
The thing is, right, the domain is different from the clients. So, like, if I talk to a server, I expect a different kind of response than when I talk to a client. So the features list is going to be different. Like, I don't expect my client to say that it supports multi-user chat. That's not something that makes sense on a client. But if I talk to my server, I kind of hope that it does, you know? So the features that you get back will vary depending on what type of entity it is and what is actually implemented. Yes.
Not Disco. I'm saying Disco like the Microsoft uses for WCF, like as opposed to Whistle for.
Oh, the this isn't a Whistle. I'm sorry. Yeah, it's similar. I would say it's similar.
And Disco protocol they use for WCF.
No, I don't think so. I'm not actually up on what Microsoft does, but I would imagine not. It's very lightweight. for one thing, at Microsoft is way lightweight. Yes?
So basically, the IQ specified what I can see, you're essentially defining what can be in that.
Right. So,
you can essentially say whatever the API is for this is just defined based on what I can see.
Yes, yeah. So like you could even create your own. And in fact, we have for a number of services, we have custom schema that are associated with the payload of these various stanzas, message, and we use message IQ. And
so really, XMPP doesn't really define what goes into an IQ.
It defines the minimal number of things necessary to make the core protocol work. And after that, it's up to the Zeps to make everything else happen. And each one of these Zeps has its own namespace that you could use to generate a proper schema and make sure that things are working correctly. And it's, even if you don't generate a schema, it's still useful for dispatching, because all you have to do is look at the namespace on something and, parse it out from there, So, like, if you use XMPP client libraries, what you'll find a lot of the time is you create hooks to get packets of a given stanza type and a given XML namespace. And from there, you could just go. Because they should be unique, and they all have like the namespace defines the semantics. So getting back to ad hoc commands, we were just talking about namespaces. Ad hoc commands are a way to create generic request response forms that are useful for if you have a task to do that's request response, and you don't want to go through the trouble of extending the core protocol, you can use an ad hoc command. Ad hoc commands are very simple. They're very much like forms in HTML, and largely modeled on them with a few modifications. For one thing, there's no style information in them. It's I don't get the impression that they really care about how it looks. They just want to be able to encode the data in a logical fashion so that things can talk to it. So what you see in these exports are things like you have titles, you have instructions, and you have a series of actions, and you have fields. And the fields can contain values, and the fields can contain options. And the fields have types. So they have a var attribute, which is the variable name for the field, and they have a type, like a list, or sorry, a text signal, means that you can put in any text. Then you have text multi, which means you can have multiple values of text. And they have like JIT signal, JIT multi, and node signal, node multi, and so on. They're all that stuff is defined in ZEP 4, which is the X data fork ZEP. And it's very, very useful just because it's easy for you to take that stuff and create a client that requests those forms, allows you to fill them in, presents you with reasonable values. So it really aids in the discovery process if you don't like to read a lot of the documentation. So basically, the things you could do with these ad hoc commands are you could request the form that you need to fill out. It's the same thing as if you were on an HTTP page, you just render an empty form. You could execute those forms by submitting them back to the server and having it do something, which could then respond to you with whether or not it succeeded or what the failure was. And for some strange reason, they also put in like wizard type functionality where you can say next, previous, cancel, and go, or their default rather. The other ZEP is 16, publish, subscribe. This implements a one to many communication, kind of an observer pattern, if you guys are familiar with that. Conceptually, it's very simple. But that ZEP actually is pretty, pretty long, at least for ZEPs, which tend to be pretty short. There are a few basic operations that you can do with publish subscribe. You could subscribe to a node, unsubscribe from a node, publish something to a node, publish an item to a node, retract an item from a node, and republish an item to a node, and list all the items on the node. The nodes are just opaque names. So you have a JIT out there, say pubsub.sizzy.org, and it implements publish subscribe. So you would send a request to it saying, publish this item on this node, and go. And then, and it doesn't really care past that. Publish subscribe has a lot of features, and it's very valuable. For instance, you can have authorized access models where when somebody tries to subscribe to the node,
It sends a message out to the person who owns the node and says, will you allow this person to subscribe to the node? It has collection nodes so that you can group many nodes together in a directed acyclic graph. So we use that, for instance, when we have a bunch of items on leaf nodes, and we connect them up so as to collection nodes, because otherwise we would have a data explosion for our architecture. It would be like n by n by x, you know. But with collection nodes, we're able to group them up in such a way so that we only create the minimal number of connections. And the other one I want to talk about is Bosch, which stands for bidirectional streams over synchronous HTTP. It's a comet-like protocol. The basic use of this is that it allows you to put XMPP on the web. And it's supported there's at least two JavaScript libraries out there that support it well today. There's JS Jack, the JavaScript Jabber client, which is pretty good. And there's Scroki, which I prefer because it's better. And you can just plug it into your browser, have it connect to something that does Bosch, to a server that uses Bosch, which are the majority of these days. And even if you have a server that doesn't do Bosch, there are standalone Bosch clients that will connect to CNS connections back to the server, and you talk HTTP to the Bosch client. The notable one there is Pungent, which is written in Twisted, Python library. The way Bosch works is like Kotlin. Well, it actually works with HTTP 1.0 of all things. All you do is you create a connection to the server, and it just sits there. You just issue your HTTP headers and nothing else, and it just holds it open until it has some data to send to you. When it's data to send to you, it sends it as a response to that long-lived connection, and then closes the connection, the client opens another one. While that connection is open, if you have data to send to the server, then you open up a new connection, send your data to the server on that connection, closes the old one, and keeps the other one as a long-lived connection until it responds. And when the server finally responds and closes it, you'll do the juggle again. So I want to kind of show you how this stuff comes together. I realize it's hard to see like how this stuff can work. So I want to put it all together for you now and show you how it happens. So I'm going to log in my SI over here. I have my XML console up. So you'll see we open our stream, and this is where the stream gets weird, because I'm using TLS. So we open our stream, the red stuff is the yellow stuff is the server talking back. It responds with its own stream, because you have to have a document going two ways to make the XML valid. It's effectively, you can't have if the server wants to talk to you, it has to create its own XML document. It asks for the features. It tells you that we can use TLS. It has it supports offline and registration, which is actually probably should do that. Once I see that it supports TLS, Sai is smart enough to reopen the stream as TLS. It gets told OK, and then we reopen the stream as TLS. Ask for the features again, we go through all that stuff. We opt, we get told that everything's good, and then it reopens the stream again. Giving me various information like the domain is Kublacon. By the way, all the stuff is live and functional today. So don't sniff my password. Get our features, and then we find a resource. So, like I was saying before, each device has a resource. Each one of these CDS connections has a resource. In this case, my resource is Natasha, which is the name of this box. But it could be anything, as long as it's unique. If there was a problem binding the resource, it would kick the app and tell me that the resources are in use. But you can generate those randomly, too. And in fact, ADIV and ICAT do that already. Sai is a little different that way. So once I do that, it goes to request my roster, gives me the stuff back. And you'll notice that I set this query here, and it's in the Jabber IQ roster namespace. So there's something on the server that sits there listening for an IQ of Jabber IQ roster. And when it gets it, it validates that everything's okay, it sends me back my entire roster, items that segregated into groups by name. Now that I have that, I send my creds. I kind of skipped over presence, which is unfortunate, because presence is actually one of the fundamental aspects of XMPP that makes it so valuable. Presence lets you know the availability of somebody. But more than that, within the scope of TCP/IP, you will know whether or not somebody is online. Because if I go offline, and even if it just disconnects badly and my network gets cut, as long as TCP/IP notices, since this is all a TCP connection, the Jabber server is going to notice. And then the Jabber server is going to send everybody, whoever sent presence to, is going to tell them that I'm offline. So you can implement services that way where if you only want like temporary subscriptions, for instance, to PubSub, if you send presence and it got told you were online and I somehow, some way go offline, that PubSub service is going to be notified that I went offline. So, like I said, it's within the limits of TCP/IP, which I think you know a lot of us are familiar with. It's not perfect because TCP/IP has has these sliding windows and stuff, so it doesn't necessarily know. In fact, there's some cases where if you don't send any data at all, it's never going to know, right? Because that's TCP/IP for you. There are workarounds for that. There are obviously apps where you can ping things back and forth. There's stream management so that you can periodically talk at the street level between servers, so that even if I'm not sending any data to the server, the server and the client are communicating behind my back to make sure that the connection is always up. Let's see, we'll skip through all this stuff. All right, so one of the other things that happens here is, what is the request? Yes, so shortly after that, we send the IQ for disco info to the server. So it comes from as an optional attribute. If you don't fill it in, the server already knows your chain because you're connected to it. And so it does it, you can just omit it and it will fill in the bulk. So we just set the IQ for disco info to the server. And at some point later, we get the response back. You can see the server supports ad hoc commands, disco, PubSub, server statistics, and it handles IQ, because a whole bunch of stuff, right? And PubSub, like I said, is very big. You can get an idea of how big it is by, like, if you look at the stage space, all the sharps after, these are all the PubSub features that it supports, and this isn't even all of PubSub. Vcard stuff, you know, right. So now that we've connected to it, I'm going to open up the service discovery browser. This is one of the things that makes Jabber, Disco so useful, is that I can just open up in almost any client a service discovery browser. And if I wanted to, I could just go through this and see what kind of stuff my server does. I can see cat rooms and IRC transport, publish, subscribe, vcard user search. But in particular, we have an API that we built on top of XMPP for our real-time communication. Oops. And the way our API works, first I have to authenticate. So here's the command, which supports ad hoc command. And it has this list on it. If you support ad hoc commands on a JIT, you can have any number of commands associated if you want. They're segregated out by what they call nodes. And this node, let's see if we can open this up a little more, is authorized plane. So if I double click on this, it opens up an export. So my component out there goes in response to this export. And I can type in my signature. Put in my password. Assuming everything works well, I did it. Now I've set my ad hoc command back and forth, and everything looks good. Yeah. So there's the response back. It tells me when my authorization is going to expire and who I'm authorized for. Now that I've done that, let's see. I'm going to subscribe to our active calls node. Because I want to see some real-time call events. So I happen to have some XML up here already that will subscribe myself to a node. This is, once I do this, see if the interface works well. We'll see in a second. Yes. So I've asked to subscribe to the node, and this is an authorized node. Like I said before, you can. It actually, once I send the subscription request, it doesn't automatically approve or disapprove it. It actually goes out and talks to the node owner of that PubSub node and asks it for approval, which, and we take that opportunity to set up a bunch of stuff behind the scenes. So it's like a lazy type of system. I get told that the subscription is pending because it had to go and ask somebody, and then a short time later it says that I've subscribed, so now I'm going to get events on it as they happen. So to show this working, bring up my point client over here. So the call came in, and you'll see we got a message from pubsub.activecalls, and it's telling me that an event happened. It happened on my VPIP, and it has a whole bunch of information about the call that I might find useful. I didn't answer that fast enough. So the call went away. Oops. Sorry. I also had it set up to go to my cell phone. Like I said, this is online. And one of the things that I want to highlight here is how fast this is. This all happens in, like I said before, near real time, and it can scale to the boot and back. Doing this kind of stuff, I mean, partly that's an Erlang thing, but it's also because the core protocol of Jabber is asynchronous. So we're going to answer this call. Now that the call is answered, we see my call ID. Right, so the call came in. And one of the things I want to show you is the other thing that I haven't shown yet is Bosch. So I have a little web client here. The web client is communicating with Bosch. And so everything, it's all written in JavaScript, it's all open. So there's no flash here, there's no hidden iframes, nothing like that. It's just your standard web client. And what it does is it gets these messages from the server. We set up all the stuff, you can subscribe to the nodes that you care about, and it gets e-events, and then renders them in the browser for you. So I can, then you can see the call is up, it's been up for 44 seconds. But I can take it, I can hang it up, and that just works the same way. It submits an ad hoc command to terminate the call. And it terminates. And it's all, so if we wanted to see this a little bit better, let's see. If you want to see how fast it is, let's take this off. It shows up instantaneously in the background. I can answer it. Oh, shit, that was pretty good. And I hang it up, and it goes away. All very, very fast. Which is the reason we chose this. So, you know, to recap, the main advantages of XMPP over traditional systems are that it's push as opposed to pull. So it can scale in a way that your pull systems can. I mean, with pull, you submit a request every so often, and you get the list of things that change. So you're always fighting this battle of bandwidth or connection latency versus speed of response. XMPP is push. You always get that thing as quickly as you can. and there's no overhead for setting those requests out as quickly as possible. So, in fact, with Bosch, over the long term, it is almost as efficient as TCP/IP for sending data to the web. I don't know how much you guys need to use push, but in my opinion, it's becoming one of the more important aspects of the web these days. People like to be notified of things in real time. You know, if you look at Facebook or Twitter or things like that, like especially Twitter buckles under the load of this constant polling. The web client makes a request and you keep having to throttle them. If they were using an XMPP system, they wouldn't have to do that. All they would have to do is be able to support a certain number of connections, and once they have that, they're good. The other thing is, not all things are appropriate for these push systems. So for instance, there's no Apache behind this web application, because Apache can't support like the number of connections we need. It tends to buckle over well before 10,000. And if you're keeping persistent connections up, you could easily break 10,000. So we end up going with, like, in this case, we're lagging to support the massive amount of concurrency that we have to deal with. Once you do that, though, there's, once you can support that number of connections, then it becomes easy to support real-time communication on a very, very large scale. And one of the other cool things about this is you notice I just use SI, which is a generic XMPP client, and I can make it work with our current service because I'm just building on top of open protocols. All the stuff that I've used is well understood and well defined. I don't have to go out there and build a custom client, except that I want to render it like in a pretty fashion. But you have to do that in Microsoft. To recap, XMPP, I think, is pretty cool. And if you need that kind of real-time access and you need to be able to support push notifications, I think it's a great way to go. That is all. You guys have any questions?
You mentioned airlines, so I suppose you were a fan of eJeopardy?
In fact, it's all back on eJeopardy.
It's all on
eJeopardy. Yeah. So there was really no other option. I have hacked on a number of servers. There are basically three popular servers out there these days. There was Jabberdy and Jabberdy 2 and OpenFire, but those are basically debunked at this point. So your options in the C arena are pretty low, basically non-existent if you want to support these the fancier apps, the newer apps out there. If you want that kind of support, your options are eJabberdy, which is probably the most supported, and it supports the most number of ZEPs, and is very, very stable. I mean, just as a virtue of being written in Python, it is extraordinarily stable. It can support a large, large number of concurrent connections. You can go with Prosody, which I've also hacked on, and Prosody is written in Lua, which struck me as a little odd, but actually it fits pretty well because, as far as I can tell, Lua is basically a wrapper around low-level C function calls, so there's not much overhead to Lua. The language itself is very tiny. Compiling core Lua is just a few modules. And the underlying architecture of Prosody is asynchronous. So they use asynchronous eventing, libevent, things like that, wherever possible. And so even that can scale very well. And in Java arena, you can use TCase, although it's well supported, but I'm not sure how well it performs. Yes.
So with your SIP system on the other side of this, I'm guessing, Cisco would be like your desktop phone as well if you're calling somebody through?
Yes. So if I were to make a call from my desktop phone, in fact, let's see, I don't know if I have a number in here. I probably don't.
Maybe could you elaborate on how the integration from, say, your desk to this system works?
What I'm going to do is, for my cell phone, I'm going to call my desk at work.
Okay.
And over here, I'm looking at my desk at work. So as soon as this call can go through, let's see. It shows up, and my desk at work is ringing.
Do you have some sort of integration, though, between the Erlang to speak SIP, or
no.
Do you have some other SIP server that's talking
yes.
to
we have
the
a, yes, that's exactly what we do. We have... as opposed to hacking all this stuff, like I mentioned components before. Components are really central to how all this stuff works. So we have a generic XFTP server that just sits there and handles the routing. You know, it's basically, you know, just handles routing fabric. And on top of that, we've written a number of components, mostly in Ruby actually, that take events from OpenSIPs, our SIP proxy, forward them on to the component, and then the component publishes those items into PubSub, the eJabberDee server. This stuff all talks to the eJabberDee server and gets those events. The ad hoc commands are the same way. If we, because each one of these saw has like commands.auth and commands.active calls. We have a number of those components that all deal with a specific aspect of the interface component to put together. So you can see over here, a voicemail. We have a voicemail command component, a PubSub component, tells me I have a call that's 0 night for August 20th.
Would the actual voicemail message be living in some sort of set component and be proxied back to your Jabber system?
Well, we're actually, our voicemail component is Asterisk, and okay. So it lives on a file system, unfortunately. It's a little bit of a problem. When we go to request this, this is a little not working at the moment, but when we go to request it, it's going to have to go and make a web request that's authenticated in some fashion, and then it'll just play it either by an audio tag or QuickTime or whatever you have available. So it's a multi-paradigm thing. It's not all XMPP. We use XMPP mainly for the signaling and for the command and for commands. There are a number of other things we had to do. So like my roster over here is fairly full, and we had to implement a component for the roster push protocol, which is another step. So there are a number of things that we support. I just didn't feel the need necessarily to go into them all because there are quite a number. Yes.
How does routing work?
I'm sorry?
How does routing work? Like, in essence, to be, you have a max reference in the
MP. Right. That's a good question. How does routing work? Like SMTP, where you have MX records, you know, with DNS now you have SRD records, and that's how it works. So there's two SRDs. You don't need them. If the SRDs aren't there, it's just going to use the A record plus a node port, you know, standard system. But if you have the SRD record there, you could point to the port and the host that will handle your CNS traffic and your SNS traffic. And those are the Jabber server, TCP, whatever the domain is, Jabber client, TCP, whatever
the same DNS base.
Yeah, and it's like, SIP does the same thing, you can use SRD. Yes, and Kerberos. Yes, SRDs are very popular, and they work well.
Is there an advantage to not using an SRD and just sticking to your A record?
No.
Resolution?
SRDs are recommended, and they're recommended for a reason. They give you more flexibility, and they give you basically no downsides, except you have to add an SRD record, or two SRD records up to for a given system. So it's worth noting that in our application, we have it segregated into a front end and a back end. So our back end doesn't publish any client server ports, because we don't want you talking to a client server. It only publishes server ports so that anybody can talk to these services. And on the front end side, we do client server and service server because there's uses for both of them as a client. Anything else? Yes?
Is there any sort of mechanism for publishing, say, like a calendar or, say, almost like a text message that it is akin to an email. You know, it's a one-way message. I don't want a response on it. Reels on it. Do you have any sort of mechanism for broadcasting to sort of like transient one-directional messages?
The message stanza is the way to do that typically. In fact, if we go back to Sai over here, you'll notice that while this is happening, it's all the PubSub system. All the stanzas I'm getting back are messages with this event. It says it's PubSub sharp event XML namespace. So this is the one-way communication. Basically, the client, or sorry, the component publishes an item to a node. The PubSub service looks at all the subscribers and then sends out a message per subscriber telling you what happened. That said, I mean, like, really, PubSub is for one-to-many communications. That's what it's suited for. And if you only want one-to-one, then you can just send a message.
So you use it in a sense to say, like, our system's going down.
Yes.
Maintenance would be that sort of thing.
Yeah, in fact, there's a step for that. A list of standard commands for administration. And if I bet you could even see them here. If I'm setting administrator, right, that would be sort of. There's actually many more than these. I don't have my other password, so I don't have to show it to you. So I'm not going to give you the ball, but there are, if you look at the staff, I can't remember the number, but, you know, like I said, there's over 200 of these in various things. That one is pretty well supported, at least Javabee supports it, and Grossby supports it. So as an administrator, if you are flagged as an administrator through the configuration of the server, then you'll be able to get this list of commands that you do. And one of them is, like, you know, send a broadcast message to all users, and or include users off or all kinds of things. Yes?
With the public subscribe system, are there any optimizations for sending the same data to a whole bunch of different people that may be hanging up on different servers?
The optimization there is nothing more than core XMPP protocol, which is, you know, S to S is a multiplexer. So if I have N users talking on one domain to N users on another domain, it still creates one connection between those two domains, and it just multiplexes all that data.
So it's going to say it'll send the same message, though,
no,
to multiple users.
Yes.
If it's the same payload, basically.
Yes.
But different subscribers.
That is correct.
There's no optimization for that.
No, there's no way to say send this message to this or this or this.
The distribution list that then has it gets to the server that those people are actually attached to gets broken up.
No, it's not. It doesn't do that. No. I'm not even sure how possible that would be in core XMPP, unfortunately, because you know, like I said, these things are all defined in XSTs, and so they have a number of constraints. One of them is you can only have one 2 attribute. I think actually that's an XMLism, right? You can only have one 2 attribute, or one attribute of a given name. So I don't see, I mean, you could potentially add data to the payload that would allow us multiplex, but as it stands now, no, you cannot. Okay. Yes?
I do one question for you. Your infrastructure that this room is running, is it ABSD infrastructure, or is it a mixed infrastructure?
I hate to break to people's limits. Said to us, I don't have much choice in these matters.
And you know where the networks
are. It's not really worth planning over for me. I like to work on fun stuff. I don't like to get involved in architecture wars, or in OS wars, rather.
Was there anything, though, in particular that you could think of that would be, in terms of like tuning your system to get this many connections, that's fairly exotic, regardless of whether it was Linux or BPC, you had to be able to work?
It depends on the number of connections you want to support. For us, we don't have that many people using it. So really all we had to do was, you know, view limit cache n 32,768, and we're off to the races, you know. But if you want to support more than, say, 65,000 connections, then you have to start doing some things because you start getting, well, it depends. I mean, it depends on how you like to do it. Theoretically, you have an infinite number of transient ports, but in practice, it doesn't necessarily work that way. As you get up there, there are things you can tune, but you know, I think for most people, unless you're very big, like out of the gate, you're not going to need to worry about it. Yes?
Through the WAVE protocol?
Yeah, so I didn't want to get into argument as possible, but you know, I can do that. I like to tout XMPP on its virtues because I think it is virtuous, but it is worth noting that a number of people are using it. From what I understand, it's heavily used in finance to do real-time trading transactions. Apple is using it for their push notification service. So, if you get the push notifications, that's all PubSub. You literally subscribe to a node, you expand PubSub, and Apple sends you a notification when something happens, your phone wakes up and does whatever it needs to do to retrieve its data. Google is using it. Actually, Google Talk is XMPP, so I can talk to people at Google Talk. And that's been working pretty much since day one. And, Wave in particular is also all XMPP. And if you've seen the demo, it's very impressive what Wave does. And that's all driven by a standard XMPP IQ. It used to be IQ only. For request response, which is necessary because they didn't have acknowledgement of whether the packet got received, and IQ is really your only way of doing that. But now they also have a publish subscribe mechanism where you pay, you can use recording. So if you don't really care, you can just send the data out, and it's much more efficient. They also, Google invented the Jingle protocol. So Google Voice, theoretically, runs Jingle these days. It's worth noting that while Google wrote Jingle, they didn't actually use it for Google Voice, but they have promised that they've mended their ways. They've updated the Jingle protocol set with the new ways being used.
So theoretically, if you have, and I haven't tried this, but in theory, I should be able to take my SciCloud here, which does support, you know, Jingle, and make it a voice call to somebody at Google Talk how to do their flashlight or whatever. So? Okay. It's been fun. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.